sahanavavatu, sahanaupunaktu, sahaviryankaravavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mahidrishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, I guess I've forgotten. Let's see. I can read this one. In meditation this morning, I found it challenging to communicate with my small children without my mind getting in the way. Do you have any guidance to give? When I don't have your voice to guide me and have to guide myself. Sure, I was just thinking that maybe, see, when the little ones are talking, like you ask, does anyone have anything to say? You know, they hear that, and a lot of times they all raise their hand at once. You have to take it one at a time. But those little ones are, they have emotional affect. You know, they're associated with every little one. Is there because they've swallowed some emotional affect, some feeling. And so when you're dialoguing in dialogue with them, you'll have a feeling that, I don't know, kind of like pulls you into it. And when that happens, there's a level of reality that has a life of its own, you know. And so then you won't have trouble. But say if your mind is distracted, or if there's something else on your mind, or you're not able to kind of get that connection where there's an emotion, some sort of emotion involved, then your mind will get distracted and think about this and think about that. It won't be as engaged. So there's a few things you can do. You can, if you say, does anyone have anything to say? Or you go down and you just kind of wait. It's almost like you follow your emotion. You follow the emotion back to its source, which is maybe the little one. And then there's an engagement. If there's no real emotion there, there's not much engagement. So when that's the case, maybe I would look for the emotion, you know, look for the feeling and be with the feeling. Even if you don't know if it's a little child or whatever it is, I would talk directly to the feeling, to a feeling. And maybe there is no feeling, you know. And so then I might talk to that. You know, there's no feeling there. What's going on? I know you're all in there, you know. So do something that helps you to connect with the feeling, because the little ones really are just an embodiment of feeling that's been repressed and hidden and removed from easy access. That's what happened when you were little, you know. And so you might not, there might be a lot of defense to those feelings coming out because they were traumatic when they happened, and they might not be ready to come out. They might need you as kind of the inner friend and the one who loves them to kind of be there for a while by yourself. You know, kind of coax them. Tell them how much you love them and you know that they're there and maybe they don't feel safe coming out. Just do that for a little while and then do something else. You know. And then go back later. Do that again so that you keep showing up, so that those parts inside feel some safety. That's just some things to try. So I guess another thing to do, if you're trying to connect with the little ones inside and that doesn't seem to be happening, they're not responding to you, I would just try to connect with your emotions. And I say, as a matter of course, throughout the day, you know, if you're having an emotional reaction, those emotional reactions are valuable for gaining that antakarana shuddhi. They're valuable if you learn how to be with them, you know, to welcome them, be with them, ask what's really going on. That's a question I always say, no, what's really hurting you? What's really bothering you? Because it's very easy and habitual to just project it out onto someone or something in the world, as though they're the cause of it. But rarely is that the case. Normally they're holding the projection, you know. And so if you go, instead of buying into that, before you buy into that, you know, I would go and be with that emotion itself. And that's how the emotion really gets resolved or healed. And so I guess that's what comes to my mind right now. So.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
Because I wrote the note and I was wondering, like, because I found when I was with myself and you were not guiding, like, from what place does my inner voice come from that says, is there something, is there someone there? It's like, because I found it easy to go up in the mind and not distracted by the mind. If the mind is the one asking, but you know, where does that inner voice talking to myself?
The buddhi, you know, like say when we're contemplating, you know, and I say, you know, just gently turn your focus toward yourself. Your buddhi can do that, you know. It just turns its focus toward the conscious being or the me. So I suggest that you do that, and it just does it. So now, instead of doing that, the buddhi is turning its focus toward the unconscious. And that's kind of amorphous. You don't exactly know where that is or where that's located, but you know the unconscious knows what you mean. When you're focusing on like that underlying, maybe I could say that underlying feeling or that world of the unknown where you know there are all of your complexes and all of your things that are stored away, you just turn your attention there. And then you ask, does anyone inside, because the complexes have a conscious component, as though it's like some libido, some psychic energy from the mind. When these complexes or traumas are broken off from the mind, they're stored. It's like some of your psychic energy actually gets stored, you know, in the unconscious, held back. And it has... you can track it down. It has feeling, you know. There's feeling. So if you address it, you'll start to feel it. It'll like start wriggling around in there in some way. And you feel that sensation, and you said, you know, you can say, you know, what I can feel you, or I can feel your sadness, or I can feel the hurt. Tell me what you're feeling. Tell me what's going on. And just try to follow that. So it's your buddhi going in and meeting your unconscious. So it's like going into the dark of the unconscious, hoping that the unconscious these complexes, they hear you when you ask, that they'll come up and meet you. You know? So you're beckoning the complexes that are there, hidden away from consciousness, to meet you, to come and to come into the consciousness of you who are you're directing your attention to that. So it's a meeting that takes place. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Good. The more you do it, the more. Yeah. More kind of natural, it becomes part of your life. Oh. That's a good question. Do the words Nirveda and Nirvana share the same root? No. I have to look up Nirveda, but the Upasarga, the prefix nir is the same, but one is going to the root vid, which becomes Veda, you know, and the other goes to the root to va, which means blowing or the wind. So that means the nir without any motion, without any wind, is nirvana. It's a Buddhist term. Nirveda, vid, the root vid actually has something like four or five different meanings, and it has five different conjugations or gunas. You know, one of them, I think the sixth guna means to the sixth, never mind, but there's just different groupings of verbs. So one group of verbs is called the sixth guna. I think that means to gain or attain, vandate. And then vid, to know, I think is the svaiti, is the second guna. And then one of the gunas, and that means to know. And then there's two or three others that have different meanings. One is like more to be or to remain or to stay. So what is nir, which root is Nirveda? That's a very easy thing to look up. If you can remind me. You can look it up, Nirveda. No, no. Do you have your thing on you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, look it up then. Your iPad. Yeah, you can just look it up. If you use, like, online, there's some wonderful dictionaries, Sanskrit dictionaries, and she can look up right now Nirveda. It'll say Nirvid, you know? And I don't know if this one that Chard is probably using is Monier Williams. It may give the etymology there, but also give the meaning, and then we can know what root it's coming from. So Nirveda, Nirveda.
I look in the Dhatu Kosha because the internet is not working here.
Oh. Okay. So first part, while she's doing that, first part of the question is no, they're definitely not the same root, right? Because Veda doesn't really have any relationship with Vana, right? The only thing similar is the Nir. And this Nir is what they call a prefix. So the prefix Nir means like without or free from. And okay, go ahead.
So Ni Upasarga Vit, causative in form. We declare oneself, indicate, offer, and trust to care of.
We may have to dig a little deeper there.
Oh, well, here's another one. Here, you can make
more. Yeah. Oh, I see. I see you're just getting the verbal root here. That's not going to work. We'll find out. I'll find out when I get to my room. Then we'll tell you.
The internet is not working.
At all?
Doesn't reach until here.
What?
The internet doesn't reach until
here. Oh, yeah. So we'll do it in my room. Yeah. Okay. So we'll put that one on hold. Okay. Please talk about bija mantras. What they are and how or for what we use them. You know, I don't know that much about the bija mantras. I'll just tell you the few sentences that I know and that's it. You know, maybe Sky and Sena or Sharda might know some more, or Emma might know more about the bija mantras in terms of maybe from a yogic perspective, but this is what I know. A lot of the mantras that we chant especially special mantras that are invoking a deity or deities. Every deity or deva has a mantra, a bija mantra associated with it. Some of the bija mantras are associated with more than one deity or more than one deva. And my understanding is that the sound of the bija mantra actually is the kind of the vibration of that particular deity. And so when you're saying that bija mantra, just by the very sound vibration of it, you're actually invoking that deity. And so that's why when Visharada told me this in a conversation she had with Pooja Swamiji, because we were wondering, I've also always wondered this, I always thought that the bija mantra was a makara that ended in the anuswara like gum, and that it would never take any type of sandhi, like to become gung because of the Ganapati. But then different teachers, pundits, actually deal with these bija mantras differently. Some will actually make the anuswara, you know, the M sound of like gum, except for om. I think om is always sacred. It never goes to any sandhi. So some of the pundits and people who were well versed in chanting will give that sandhi to the bija mantra if it's not om. And so, like for instance, gum would become gung. And so it'll take on the regular sandhi rule that's associated. But what Pooja Swamiji said was, bija mantra should never take a sandhi. It should always, the sound itself should, it should be complete. The sound should be closed as it is. And so if the bija mantra is hrim, it's not going to become hrim. It'll be hrim or shrim, you know, or gum, whatever it happens to be. And so it doesn't go through any type of sandhi. So that being said, when we say that bija mantra, I was explaining a little bit. Maybe I have the Atharvashirsha. I could actually bring that in and tell you this, is translate this little area for you. When you're saying that om, or I would take that to all of the bija mantras, the om gets an immediate, the anuswara gets an immediate closure, om. So there's no elongation. There's no om. We sometimes do that, but no, it should be om. Where the elongation comes is in the om, the ma goes up through the nose, through the nasika. You can feel it vibrating in the nose. It's called nada or something like that. So it's just one of the stages of the mantra, of the, like om. So om, and you can feel that coming up and going into silence. It makes it very, very powerful. And if you say that bija mantra in kind of a full voice, you can find like even the tone where it has the most, resonates the most, and that feels very, very powerful in a way of invoking the deity. And you can actually look up, even on Google, though it's a little kind of superficial, but you'll get the idea if you Google it. You know, bija mantras, there's quite a bit. And what it'll do is give different lists of bija mantras and talk about each one of them, which deity is being invoked and that type of thing. So you get a little bit of understanding, though it's kind of, I wouldn't teach anything about it off the internet. I would want to really talk to like a pundit, somebody, or Swamiji, or somebody who really knows. But it'll just give you some idea of what people are saying about it. And you can see that it's a little on the flaky side, but nevertheless, and many, many different types of people are writing about these things. But you'll see lists of bija mantras and what that sound symbol is invoking. One other thing about the tradition with chanting. If say if the pundits and different people are doing it in different ways, say they're saying gum or gum, and your guru says, no, it's gum, that's good enough. For us, it's gum. That's the tradition. So I'm sure when I know that if Bhagishananda had learned from some of the pundits that it was gum, when Swamiji said it's gum, for Swamiji, it's, from that point on, it is gum. That's it. And that's our tradition. It's a beautiful tradition. Because that's where our Shraddha is. You know. So for us, it's gum. I think it is gum. Anyway. But I'm talking just about something very beautiful in terms of our Shraddha, the Shraddha, you know.
I'd ask that question to Swamiji almost every year, I think. What about the Vinja? He says, you'll know by chanting. Just keep chanting it. And then it I guess what he's implying is it kind of talks to or connects you enough, or maybe it satisfies itself, or the question goes away, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe, it means all of those things, and also the more he, but Swamiji with his beautiful voice and Shraddha, he gets just the right tone of the Bija Mantra, and something opens up inside. Yeah. It's happened to me once or twice. And it was I couldn't repeat it. But I must have hit just exactly the right frequency, exactly the right tone. And as you're chanting and chanting, I can imagine with Swamiji, because he gets into such a beautiful space with it. He just hits it perfectly. And then the power of it is something that reveals itself. That's what also possible. You know? I think there's something in it that's, you know, special. Because it's a Bija Mantra. Right. That's nice. You said something about discussions of karma in the Shastra. Is Krishna redefining or setting this karma discussion to an end here in the Gita? Are there other versions of karma in the Vedas or even in some of the Upanishads? Maybe a weird question, but there are a lot of other philosophical systems within the culture of India. Are there not? Yeah, many. Some dualistic and so on. Well, how we're talking about the karma as it's taught in the Karmakanda, that is how it is taught in the Karmakanda. That's what it is. You know, the I do the karma. The karma in order to get a particular result. Like say, I do, these are called kamya karmas. Karmas that are directed, karmas means rituals that are directed toward a given desire. So the common one that we quote is the putra kameshti. I do this karma called the putra kameshti because of a kama for a child. That's why I'm doing it, because of my desire, you know, for a child. And so I have that desire for a child, and with the Karmakanda, the first portion of the Veda says, if you have that desire, then you can perform this ritual and you will be blessed with a child, you know. So the first part of the Vedas has to do with doing rituals, they're called the Nitya karmas, which are things that nitya karmas are rituals that I should do on a daily basis. And then if I'm a brahmana, there may be specific rituals. If I'm a man, I would do. If I'm a woman, I would do. If I'm unmarried, I would do. And then when I was a brahmachari, and then when I'm married, there's other rituals that I would do that are just your duty to do, you know, before Agni, before the gods, you know. It's how you participate in this creation, and you're expected to do that every on a daily basis. Like if you're married, you would do the Agnihotra on a on a daily basis. And if you're a brahmachari, there's a couple of others that you do on a daily basis. And then you do the Agnihotra once you become married. And then if you're a sannyasi, you do rituals at the time of sannyasa to give up all of those karmas. You know, so these karmas are very important in terms of your relationship with the divine, with Ishwara, with the gods. There's nitya naimittika. The naimittika karmas are karmas that are enjoined, that are considered very very important. One of them is shraddha, different than shraddha. Shraddha. That's the when your own family member dies, if your parent dies, every year on the date of their death, you do the shraddha karma in order to neutralize any papa karmas that may be hindering them in any way, and to send lots of punya their way to help them to attain a good next birth and to be in the higher lokas, you know, while they're traveling. And so these karmas are really for your ancestors. You know, so that's even Swamiji, there were four of them. He was the eldest of four brothers. And after the mother died, every year on the appropriate date, the three brothers would get together to do the karma. Swamiji is a sannyasi, so he could not do the karma, but he would go and bless that karma every year that it was done. I think we should shut the door. Is it okay for everybody? So yeah, you don't have a sweater on. It's really cool. So I think that what Krishna or the Vedas are saying about the first portion of the Vedas is just well known. It's a matter of fact. And so if you're within the tradition, you're just talking about what it actually is in a very, very calm and acceptable way. And in the second part of the Vedas, the Vedanta, some of these karmas, especially the nitya naimittika karmas, until you take sannyasa, are enjoined on you to perform. You know? So now, if you're no longer interested in punya and papa, you know, getting rid of the papa and accruing punya and getting a better next birth, how do I then perform these karmas? The sankalpa then for me changes from performing them so that I can accrue punya and get a better next birth. And the kamya karmas, I don't do at all. So this is just talking from the Hindu, you know, cultural. The kamya karmas, the ones that are in order to fulfill desires, I don't do those karmas now as a mumukshu. But I do the karmas that are enjoined on me. And I do those karmas not for punya papa, get rid of papa or to gain punya. I do them for antakarana shuddhi, right? And so even the karma yoga buddhi, if we're looking at it in terms of somebody who's contained within the karma kanda, the first portion of the Vedas, all of the karmas that I do, and I do all of my duties, all of the things that are expected of me, and I do all of my karmas, but the karmas, you know, and the charities, the dhanam, you know, the taking care of the etiti, the uninvited guest, all of these, I do all of these things to please for Ishwara's pleasure, to please Bhagawan. And if it's not to please Bhagawan, it's to do my duty, you know. Not that I feel that Bhagawan, Swami talks both ways. Not that I feel I'm doing this so Bhagawan, I'll get a nod from Bhagawan. You know, they smile at me, you know. So that wanting to please Bhagawan is more that this is my duty, I do what is to be done, you know. Just for the sake of doing what is to be done. As that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, it's as an offering to Bhagawan, and I receive everything with that prasada buddhi. So I continue to do my karmas, the rituals that are enjoined. I do it because I'm enjoined to do so, and I do it for antakarana shuddhi, not for punya and papa. So my sankalpa is different. But I think that everything that is being said is not something new to the Gita or new to any of the Upanishads. It's just kind of like what the tradition is. That makes sense. It's not just Krishna's idea in the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, it's actually how the whole thing is viewed. Having, I did this one. Did I not finish it, maybe? Having a karma yoga attitude. A question about having a karma yoga attitude and learning to have samatvam. Is it the case that the emotions we have when a result arrives are themselves part of the karmapala, and so we can, well, experiencing the emotions, also stay objective towards them and accept them as a result, something that we can't change? Let me think about that. Having a karma yoga attitude and learning to have samatvam. Is it correct that the emotions we do still have when a result arrives are themselves part of the karmapala, and so we can, well, experiencing the emotions also, stay objective toward them and accept them as a result, something we can't change? Well, I'm not quite sure how to answer that, so there's a couple of things I can say about that. First of all, the samatva buddhi gives me the freedom to do the action, right? Whatever that action is that is there to be done, or even if the action has to do with the raga dvesha, I can do that raga dvesha, accepting the fruits of the action as prasad. Okay? Eventually, the raga dvesha is dropped off. We just do the actions that are asked of me. And the desires that I have, I can fulfill those desires, but we don't call them desires exactly, because my ananda is not dependent. We'll see this actually in the next couple of verses. I'm doing this in order to be happy, but if it doesn't, because I want to. I'm doing it because I want to. It would be nice if it works out, but my ananda, my wholeness, is not at stake. So that's called a preference. Swamiji calls them non-binding desires. I have a desire, but if I cannot fulfill that desire, it's not successful, I'm okay. My ananda is not at stake. So we actually don't call those as desires. We're talking about desires in the Shastra. We're talking about binding desires. And so, say I have a binding desire, and with that binding desire, means it does matter to me, you know, because I'm still caught up in that, but I have that karma yoga buddhi, I can go ahead and do that, try to fulfill that desire. And when I don't get it, I can take that as prasad. And then I can try again in a different way or in a different way. But I'm taking each time I take as prasad. So the prasada buddhi will negate the emotional reaction, because the prasada buddhi is what is important to me if I'm a mumukshu. However, another way to answer this is not, I don't know how to answer it really differently right now within the prasada buddhi paradigm. But say, if we look at this life, the prarabdha karma is 50-50, about 50-50. 50-50 punya, 50-50, 50% punya, 50% papa. The 50% punya is creating situations, the prarabdha is creating situations which are conducive to your happiness. They are as though fulfilling a desire. When these situations come, you're happier, you have shanti, they're good for you, they're, you know. The other ones, the papa, and the papa is unfolding or expressing itself, those situations are not conducive to my happiness. They're conducive to my sorrow, you know. If I don't have that karma yoga buddhi, if I have the prasada buddhi, then I can accept all of them with that prasad and I have the samatvam. But if I don't have the karma yoga buddhi, there are many instances in your life that are really not geared for your happiness. They create sorrow and stress or worry, depending on my attitude. If my attitude is one of a karta, where I'm responsible for the results of the action, then I will suffer that, right? Because that particular situation was really kind of designed to create stress for me or unhappiness for me. What's interesting, though, is that doesn't mean I have to be unhappy. Depends on my attitude as how I'm going to receive that, you know, stressful or rather, you know, unpleasant or painful situation. I have free will, in a sense, over my response. And if I have knowledge and I'm a mumukshu and I understand that the ananda is myself and it's not out there, then my whole relationship to sukha and dukkha, or pleasure and pain, is very, very different. You know, pleasure and pain means an event that's meant to cause pleasure, an event that's meant to cause pain. I have a different type of orientation toward that. My orientation is toward Ishwara and having that prasada buddhi, and so then I don't subject to it in that way. For a jnani also, it's not like we don't expect difficult situations, but my ananda is just simply not at stake. It's never had been at stake. It's only been at stake because of ajnanam, because you've projected your ananda onto something where it doesn't exist at all anyway. And so then we can just be objective to all of the situations, especially the difficult ones. There definitely are difficult situations. Nobody skates through on this loka without having challenges, you know, and things that really stretch you and make, and for us, they're fine. They make us grow. That's our attitude, because actually, you know, we want our ananda and my own mind, my buddhi, to be full and complete in itself, because the self is full and complete in itself, you know. So I don't want to be subject to these projections of ananda and then running out and trying to make myself happy. And so when these difficult situations come up, they just become something that I try to handle in the best way that I can. But I don't get myself pulled into it. And if I do get myself pulled into it, that's my sadhana. Pull myself back out. Do some work on that. So next time I won't get sucked in. So. Can you please clarify the difference between upayanishta and upayanishta? The upaya, upaya is referring to the instrument, you know, the instrument that in this case is going to be receiving this knowledge. The upaya is the thing that is going to be received. So the upaya here is, the upaya is the knowledge itself. So what are the means, the upaya nishta, that commitment to gaining this knowledge? What is the sadhana for the upaya, gaining that firmness, you know? What is the sadhana for it? Gaining that firmness in brahmajnanam, in atmajnanam. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. The upaya nishta is the instrument or the receptacle that needs to gain the knowledge. And so the receptacle that needs to gain this knowledge is the antakarana, the buddhi, right? And so that buddhi, you know, needs to gain antakarana shuddhi in order to be available for this knowledge, and to be both available for the knowledge and to have a disposition which contains the knowledge. So that's why the karma yoga is considered really, and that's the karma yoga in terms of your attitude to the world, following dharma, you know, taking all the results of my action as prasad, that prasada buddhi from Ishwara. That is considered the sadhana because it gives me a mind that is so close to the mind of a jnani, you know. The only difference between it is the jnani and the karma yogi is the kartvatvam. That sense of doership is still there, that ahankara is still there. It hasn't resolved into myself so that I recognize everything is Ishwara. So upayanishta means What are the means? The nishtha means that at complete commitment, the commitment, you know, the firmness in terms of the maturity in terms of the antakarana, that upaya nishtha. The means for that is karma yoga. And there's other things also for the upaya nishtha, like say if your mind is always doesn't have any steadiness, we can use upasana for that. That's one of the things that they use, where the exercises to help your mind. It's called chitta ekagrata. Making eka, ekagrata means making single pointed. Eka means one and agra means a tip. Right? So ekagrata means that state of being single pointed for the chitta, for the mind. So chitta ekagrata. Upasana is often taught for that. And different types in the Ashtanga yoga, different types of what they call dharana, you know. Dharana means where I'm holding my mind on something, and then it matures into dhyanam. As I hold my mind on a single point, then I get what's called like an anuvritti, a continual flow of thought modifications flowing into that particular point. So there's these types of exercises to help make my mind more single-pointed, because it's always... Some people say, my mind just never stops. And it just never stops. And so there's exercises to help with that, different forms of pranayama also help a lot with that. But underlying it all is the prasada buddhi dharma, the kaushalam, you know, and then the samatva, which is the prasada buddhi. Because that takes away much of the cause for the unsteadiness of the mind. Mind is distracted here and there and here and there. And so with the prasada buddhi, the samatva and the kaushalam, then the mind gains a natural composure. But still, it might be, you know, agitated. So then things like pranayama, even japa is helpful. But the underlying one is the prasada buddhi. Ishwara is rolling out our life. Can you talk a little bit more about which role our intentions play in this setting? Are they possibly superfluous? Swami Vagishananda often talks about, be careful what you order, because the universal restaurant will deliver. Yeah. So our wishes will be heard in one way or another by Ishwara. Well, in one way or another, you can look at it that your prayers or your intentions, or since you look at the intention as a sankalpa, that's actually considered a karma, because I am with my mind, I'm making an intention for something that I want. That's it's called manasa karma. It's a mental karma. And so say in a prayer, that's a karma. I'm praying for the well-being of someone or of myself or whatever it may be, whatever the prayer may be. So that karma is being delivered into the universe. It's being given to Bhagavan. And so that has to be received. It may not get what you want. But nevertheless, even in this world, a lot of the actions that we do, they don't give us, we don't get the results that we want, but nevertheless, we have done the action. And so when somebody is ill or whatnot, we pray for them. And we visualize them and we ask Bhagavan, you know, we try to see them as whole and ask Bhagavan to give his blessings. And so we're putting energy in that direction, you know. So when he says, let's see, I don't think that those intentions are necessarily at all superfluous. Almost meaningless. You're asking Bhagavan to do something that Bhagavan's either going to do or not going to do, and so, you know, what's the purpose of doing them? But there's a lot of stories, you know, in the Shastra and the Mahabharata and Ramayana of the efficacy of prayer, you know, and say, and even the in Jyotisha, they'll look at it like this, is say when a child is born, they look at the child's chart, and they say, at this time the child is 5 years old, there's a problem here. And so at that time, during this time when the child is going to turn five, you need to do these particular rituals, you know, to see if you can alter or mitigate the effects. Mitigate means lessen the effects of what this particular constellation can bring about. And so if there's any opening in the chart for mitigating the effects of that constellation, then these karmas and things will be done and prayers will be done in order to try to neutralize or lessen or lessen what is there to happen. And so I would say that your prayers, what they say in Jyotisha and what Swamiji said before, if it's cast in stone in the chart, you know, then your prayers probably won't be able to divert or lessen the effects of that particular karma or that particular constellation and that particular part of your prarabdha. But if there's leeway there, then your prayers can really be helpful, you know. And so then, say the prayers do have that power to help, and then of course you have to look at the opposite. The curses also are going to be in the same. They also have their effect. And when you're in the Mahabharata and Ramayana, they also, you know, talk about that, like the power of the Mahatmas or the Mahayogis doing curses and burning everything down, but then they waste a lot of their tejas by doing that, you know. So they accept these things as karmas. So when that's the case, what Swamiji said once, Puja Swamiji, is that if you're going to have an intention, you can first say to Bhagawan, have an intention or a sankalpa, Bhagawan, if this is good for, if Bhagawan blesses me and feels this is good for me, then this is my intention. This is my sankalpa. But only if Bhagawan blesses it. If you think it would be bad for me, you're the one who knows, then ignore. Please ignore. So that's what Swamiji Vagishananda means. Be careful what you order, because the universal restaurant will deliver. You know? So our wishes will be heard in one way or another by Ishvara. Yeah, because they're entering the creation. And the creation is sarvajnatvam, you know. Another kind of, I think, a helpful, meaningful way to think about this is, imagine you're having a dream. You're the Ishvara of the dream. And the dream can be a huge dream. It can be any dream. Someone in that dream is praying to you. Do you hear it or not? Someone in your dream, you know, means they're in your being, you know. The whole thing is reflected as your mind. We say for Ishvara will be infinite mind, but for Ishvara it's just his mind. It's not an infinite mind or a little mind. It's just mind, you know. Just like your mind is just mind, okay. So now in that mind, somebody is praying to you in that dream. And then you hear it, you know. And so then you can send your blessings, you know, or whatever takes place, but you hear it, there's a response. So I would look at it like that. Because some people think, are my prayers heard? You know? Well, the prayers are taking place. This body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara's swarupa, you know, his form. And so how can they not be heard? We just can't imagine, like, be some sort of a cacophony of all of these, all these people praying, thousands, billions of people praying at the same time, and all the animals screaming and this and that and that. All the children crying, everything going crazy, you know, so much noise going on. How is Bhagawan going to be able to sort all that out? Well, let me tell you a little story about dogs. I don't know why this came to me, but I like it. It's nice. Do you know that dogs have this extraordinary sense of smell? Extraordinary sense of smell. So an example is given for dogs. that if you were to make a big stew, big pot of stew, and in that pot of stew you had all different kinds of vegetables and spices and meats and all of these kind of things in it, when you were to smell that big boiling pot of stew, you would just smell the scent of the stew. That smells good, you know. But a dog will smell every single item in that boiling, you know, stew. Every item, one by one, distinguishes every single item, you know. So if a dog can do that, you know, Bhagawan can do it. I thought that was really good. I sometimes, you know, it's funny what comes to your mind. Anyway, so yes, our wishes are heard because they take place in consciousness. They take place in Ishwara. And there's nothing in Ishwara, just like there's nothing in your mind that is not known. It's true for Sarvajñatvam also. I know that what throws us off is because from our little standpoint, Ishwara is just too big for me to even matter. Which from our standpoint, it's probably true. It's like, from my standpoint, I'm not even the size of a little ant or even a bacteria, you know, or a little molecule. How could I mean anything to Bhagawan, you know? That's how we look at it. But from Bhagawan's standpoint, that's not what it is. This is me. It's not big or small. Even if the creation is absolutely infinite in size, that's from your standpoint, not from Bhagawan's standpoint. So I think that's an important little piece of information to review things from our own standpoint, and then we become very tiny compared to Ishwara, you know. I don't think it has to do with big or small. Can you please unfold Pratipaksha Bhavana? Well, I think I'll do it tomorrow because actually it's a really good question. Pratipaksha Bhavana. You can tell stories about it and stuff. It's nice. Why don't we keep Pratipaksha Bhavana for tomorrow and do a couple of bhajans now? We've got like 5 minutes. Oh, good, very good.
Sada bhajore, sada bhajore.
sada bhajore,
sada bhajore,
sada bhajore,
sada japore,
sada japore,
nama nama tarakam sada bhajore,
nama Sit Prajabhyah Paripalayantam. Shubhamastunityam Lokasamasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Deshoyam Chobarahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhat Bhavet Asato Ma Satgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.